Accession number 27347, reel 21.
Only brand, reel 21.
After Inskip, the next move was to go to an operational squadron. Because I'd been trained for anti-submarine work, this was obviously to be 836 Squadron, which was then based at Maydown, having been moved from Macrahanish. Macrahanish was on a peninsula in Scotland, very inaccessible, out in the wilds, nothing to do except train. Even leave took, sort of, you lost 48 hours of your leave to get down to Glasgow and back. So although Macrahanish was beautifully accessible from the sea and had every facility for training, like target ranges, rocket ranges, bombing ranges, all the rest of it, it was so inaccessible that they moved it over to Maydown, which was on the shores of the loch that Londonderry is on. Londonderry, of course, was convenient for all frigates, escort work, and they established a submarine school there. Maydown was an airfield about 4 miles away from the submarine school, so it was ideal. We spent quite a lot of time at the anti-submarine warfare school, and they spent quite a lot of time with us, so that we got some idea of what it was like to go out in a submarine, and they got an idea of what it was like to try and attack one. In addition, we were near a place called Eglinton, where there was a school where you did a lot of blind flying instruction. I went over to a school there on Oxford's twin engine and did a lot of blind flying, which was useful. It gave one the confidence that if you suddenly hit bad weather, you're going to cope with it. Blind flying is normally looked upon with horror by most pilots, but to us it was a means of salvation. You could hit a bank of fog and you're going to get through it. You're going to save your life by what you'd learned. Whilst we were waiting for a ship to be appointed to a MAC ship, they kept us on our toes training. Bombing, navigation exercises over the Atlantic, interspersed with trips across the border into Southern Ireland, where we could get all the bacon and eggs that healthy young chaps of 20 look forward to.
Would you go in uniform when you went across the border? Or were you...
No, we went in civvies. We had civvies with us because being appointed to 836 Squadron, we were in a funny position. We were going to be flying from a merchant navy ship, which was not supposed to be offensively armed. Civilians could only be defensive. If you were offensive as a civilian, you could be shot. And we often wondered what would happen to us if we attacked a submarine and were shot down and picked up by the submarine crew, whether they'd take us back to Germany to be shot, or whether they'd do it there and then. It was a funny situation. We were civilians, and yet we weren't civilians.
And I think 836 Squadron was a very different type of squadron, really, than all the other police air arm squadrons, wasn't it?
Very much so, because with its contact with the Merchant Navy, operating altogether 19 merchant aircraft carriers, which were grain ships and oil tankers, we had a different outlook to the straight-laced Royal Navy personnel. Royal Navy personnel always seemed to look down on Merchant Navy mariners. We learned to look up to them because they were the salt of the earth. They took 19 Merchant Navy skippers and gave them a fortnight's course, and then put them in charge of a merchant aircraft carrier, which had to operate as a carrier in a convoy in confined spaces. And they did it wonderfully. Not only that, they commanded a ship where they were outnumbered by naval personnel. We used to carry a total of about 130 people aboard a MAC ship, of which 90 or 100 would be naval personnel, and the 30 or 40 people would be merchant navy. To be in that position with the power of life and death, as skippers always have to have aboard their own ship at sea, he could be in a very difficult position, because there were ground rules which nobody could change, like the Merchant Navy Union rules. We couldn't expect for a minute to overcome those. At the same time, Royal Navy discipline could be very harsh, and Merchant Navy people could rebel against it. To be a skipper in charge of such a mixed crowd, not only did he have naval personnel and Merchant Navy personnel, he also had army personnel for manning the armaments that we had, the 4-inch gun on the stern, and the Ehrlichans and Bofors guns that we had for aircraft defence.
I think you were quite widely deployed as a squadron as well, as opposed to another squadron that may operate together as well, weren't you?
Well, with 19 ships which were fully occupied backwards and forwards across the Atlantic, any personal relationships were disrupted immediately, because you could go for 2 years and never meet up with another flight because they're on a ship that was at the opposite end of the Atlantic to you all the time. It was the biggest squadron that ever happened, even up to today. By having so many personnel, management of that could have been quite difficult. Not only that, if we'd been Royal Air Force, a flight commander would have 3 aircraft. In the Navy, a flight commander would have 3 aircraft. A squadron leader in the Navy, in the RAF, would have 12 aircraft. We had nobody in command of 12 aircraft. We had a lieutenant commander equal to a squadron leader in command of over 100 aircraft. In the RAF, it would have been at least a group captain.
How did he administer the squadron then? sense?
Just by sheer intelligence, although there are all sorts of rumours. Besides the 100 aircraft and the 100 pilots, 100 observers, 100 air gunners, of course, there are all the ground crew, the maintenance crew, amounting to well over 1,000. And the rumour went that the office block that they had a big long corridor running along one side of the block with pigeonholes all down the wall. Now, with so many personnel, you needed so many pigeonholes. It covered the whole wall. So one of them had to be near the main door. And the one that happened to be by the main door was the reserve crews, the ones who were available for appointment whenever there was a vacancy. Now, we used to get quite considerable gales over there, and the reports were that when a gale came and the door flung open and all the little dockets in the reserve area were blown down the corridor. They were left there until the cleaners came along at night, and they swept them up and popped them into any vacancy along the rest of the corridor. And the one marked leave was right at the far end of the corridor and never got disturbed. All sorts of rumours, but really the office staff did a wonderful job to keep track of the various skills that were needed.
Could I ask, when you actually joined, you mentioned a couple of bits of training as well that you did, one of them being in a submarine. Did you actually go down in the submarine?
I went out in a submarine from Heysham when I was at Inskip. Only went out one afternoon, night, and came back the next afternoon. But it was long enough for me.
How did it feel to be inside a
submarine? Oh, it's horrible. Just as horrible as the submariners found it to be in the back seat of a swordfish. At the piss-up at the end of the course, we all got happy with drink, and we were pals for life, and we swore that we'd rather be shot than do the other's job.
And you also mentioned while you were main down, though, navigating over the Atlantic.
Yes.
Did that differ from the exercises that you've done over the Irish Sea?
Not really, except that we had a foreign country that had to be avoided. You didn't have the ability to action during a panic as you would like to do. You had to avoid going down into Ireland.
What would have happened if you had have had to make a landing in Ireland?
Theoretically, we would have been interned for the rest of the war. In practice, they used to turn out and provide us with petrol and help us get back. They'd give us free telephone calls to our family to tell them they were all right, and to the squadron to tell them how to come and pick us up. And they would even let a naval lorry come along with personnel to service the aircraft to get it airborne again. If it was in a field that was too small to fly out, yes, it would be quarantined. But generally, we found ways and means of, if you could get into a field, you could get out of it.
And I was just thinking, with the flights over the Atlantic, obviously it's a bit more vast again, so were you getting a feel for how different it would be than, say, when you had trained in the Irish Sea, though?
Yes. In the Irish Sea, you could almost see land all the time. Isle of Man, Anglesey. You didn't have the feeling of the vastness and the remoteness. You didn't have that knowledge that you were a tiny, insignificant speck that didn't matter. In the Irish Sea, you were always somebody. The other thing that I give credit to the office staff for is that they managed to pick people to cover all the things that needed to be done aboard an aircraft carrier for which we didn't have regular personnel. If we'd had personnel for packing parachutes, for meteorology, for armaments, for stores and all the rest, we would have needed an aircraft carrier the size of an American modern one with sort of 3,000 people aboard. We had 120 of 130, of whom 90 or 100 were naval personnel. We had to do stores and photography and meteorology and help the medics, and there was a bit of everything to be done. And the office staff used to pick and send people who were capable of taking on duties like that, although we had no training. I reckon that, in a way, this showed that somebody at the Admiralty knew our records and appointed us to 836 Squadron for our versatility and breadth of background and intelligence and so on. I reckon that this is why we were all RNVR. There were hardly any RN straight-laced people there. The only RN people were the squadron CO, his senior pilot, his senior observer, medical people, some instructors, and as far as I remember, that was it. The rest of us were RNVR. And of course, being RNVR, we had a certain amount of civilian background which we were bringing to use in an isolated community at sea where we had to do somebody else's job.
This period of training before you embarked on the carrier when you were at Maydown with the squadron, how long did that take?
Until there was a vacancy. If you're unfortunate to arrive at Maydown the day a ship came in with sickness amongst the air crew, you'd be out there the next day. If there'd been a collection of MAC ships over this side and they'd only just left when you arrived, you had at least 6 weeks to find your feet.
And when had you arrived, and how long did you have to wait?
I had to wait about 2 months. This was because at that time they'd stopped sending two carriers with each convoy. We were down to a single carrier, and they were returning some of the grain ships to providing food because they knew that the relief of Europe was coming and they needed the grain over here. So grain ships were being converted back to grain carrying.
Where did the concept of the MAC carriers come from?
There was just one captain who had this idea that MAC ships were essential and that Fleet Air Arm people could operate from a small ship. I forget his name. I'll look it up later and we'll introduce it, because he deserves a medal and he didn't get one. It was really the pressure at the conferences just before a convoy left, where all the merchant navy skippers were there, and they were saying, air cover, where's the air cover? We want air cover. And the Admiralty people who were there had to keep saying, but we haven't got any carriers. So somebody must have said, well, how about the German ship Hanover, which you did convert to a carrier? You put six Wildcats aboard her, and she shot down so many Focke-Wulf Condors. She only did two trips before she was torpedoed. But why can't you do this for us and protect the convoy by having constant patrols around it to keep the subs down? Because once you keep them down, you'll stop this night after night after night attack that we're getting. It was really demand from the merchant navy skippers, and full marks to them for doing it.
And the conversions, you touched on it a little bit, but were they specific types of vessels that were converted?
Yes, grain ships and oil tankers had to be chosen, because they could take in and discharge cargoes without having huge holds and hatches and holes in the deck to lift things in and out. Oil could be pumped, grain could be blown, blown in, blown out. The grain ships had big holds which could be merged together to form a hangar, which was a godsend on the North Atlantic. Oil tankers couldn't, unfortunately. So oil tankers had no hangar at all, and the aircraft had to be tied down on deck, which was a nightmare for the ground crew and for the pilots and observers and air gunners, to have a cold aircraft which was difficult to start, difficult to maintain, and working at night you were so restricted with light in the middle of a convoy in mid-Atlantic. You couldn't go flashing torches all over the place. No, it was very restricted, but with the will to do something about it, it could be achieved, and the will was there.
And would they carry a full cargo as well?
The grain ships used to lose a hangar, lose one compartment, which meant that they carried about 80%. The oil tankers, because they had to carry aircraft fuel in one of the tanks, could carry about 95% of their normal cargo, which in addition was a godsend, because carrying Admiralty fuel oil and being so aware of the need for escort ships, we could refuel corvettes and frigates at sea from the tanker. And this was first done, I think, by Lord Kilbracken's crowd, who actually flew off for a panic whilst they were still refueling with hoses at sea. This meant that after an intensive submarine hunt, where corvettes and frigates were dashing about at full speed and covering extra miles and using up a lot of fuel, we didn't have to dispatch them to Iceland or back to the UK or forward to Halifax, they could be refueled at sea, and so they stayed with the convoy. You can imagine, to dispatch two corvettes or frigates out of an escort force of six and lose them for the rest of the convoy, it was quite a saving to have a MAC ship that was prepared to refuel at sea. And I reckon that it was because they chose the adventurous and skippers with a lot of initiative that we started to refuel at sea. Before that, it hadn't been considered.
And do you pilots have a preference for flying from a converted tanker or a converted grain ship?
Well, all tanker people prefer to fly from a tanker. All grain ship people. It's a loyalty. It's an inborn thing. Esprit de corps. Whatever you were with was the best one. They had their advantages and they had their disadvantages. We used to have a pride in being able to keep our aircraft serviceable under these terrible conditions. And human effort didn't come into it. It was there. It was readily given in the cold and misery of it all. On a tanker, and consequently we had a pride in being on a tanker. The other thing was that with a grain ship, because you couldn't you wouldn't bring the aircraft up until you had to fly them, and as soon as they'd flown them you'd strike it down into the hangar, they always had the full run of the deck. We had a slippery steel deck going uphill and downhill, uphill and rolling to one side and then the other side, and we had to manoeuvre 3 or 4 tons of aircraft along that deck by hand, and we had to park them. We had to park them up in the bow if we had an aircraft to land on, or we had to park them in the stern if we wanted to take off. So we lost deck use. To be coming into land with the knowledge that there were two aircraft parked up in the bow with a barrier across gave you a steel wall to fly into. Knowing that if you had to go around again, you'd have to clear that lot. We could well have done without them. We would have liked to have seen them struck below into a hangar. But the fact that we could do it gave us a pride in being on a tanker, not like these sissies on a grain ship, and vice versa.
With the MAC ships as well, was there an additional threat to them in a convoy? Would they be seen as a target, do you think, by you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, any carrier is an attractive target for a U-boat. To come in with a carrier painted on the conning tower would have been something. Not only that, they looked upon us as a bigger threat to them than a merchant ship with a 4-inch cannon aboard. So if they could pick us off, they'd do that first. We were the prime target.